and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we are here with episode 221 and part two of my conversation with University of Northern Colorado percussion professor Julie Strom. We did this. The semester is over. Grades are completely in. Maybe it's time for a short break, because you know what? We all need it. I truly hope that you are all healthy and well, and your loved ones are also. Whether you're at home with your families or with friends or even by yourself in this most unusual and challenging of years, I'm thinking of all of you. Take care of yourselves and each other during this time. All right, let's get back to Julie. In part one last week, which I hope you've already listened to, we heard about what she's doing now, her PASIC presentation, and the path to the start of her doctorate degree. In part two, we start with her time at Northern Colorado with Gray Barrier, her years in Canada and her freelancing, and an extended version of our usual closing segment. One note before we start. Once again, as has unfortunately been the case a bunch recently, the usual recording got corrupted, so much of this interview is saved from my backup, which the audio is just not as good. So my apologies for some of the audio that you are going to hear and the level that it is at. Just wish it was better. But that's what we got, so we will move on and get to our chat. We recorded this interview over Skype on October 23rd and November 4th, 2020, and it begins right now. What did he see that were things that, like, you know, where did you need the work, or where was the next step for you in terms of your own growth as a percussionist?
Well, because I had done so much orchestral work, and then with Peter Sadlow, I had done a lot of solo work in chamber playing. I mean, Peter Sadlow was one of the best percussionists I've ever known, but I never once saw him touch a hand drum, you know. He did nothing, zero, like with world percussion, unless it was in like marimba spiritual. So that, you know, and like I said, with my bachelor's degree, I had done, you know, these wonderful master classes with some of the best players in the world, but they were really like a brief stints of education. And with Gray, you know, that was really the first time that I sat down and he said, you know, okay, here's the difference. Here's when we use tumbao. Not can you just play tumbao, but like, here's when we actually use it. And here's the difference between bolero and merengue and songo and caballo. And, you know, here, okay, this is where we use rumba clave. This is where we use song clave. Like, he was the first one to really lay it out for me. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a lot of world percussion that I knew I needed under my belt, which I still have yet to learn. I feel like I could still learn a lot in that area, as well as jazz vibraphone. You know, he did his best at trying to flood me with knowledge of jazz vibes, And I shame myself, because I think at that time I was just kind of almost like, I just felt done with school. And so, you know, and that was my own pride getting in the way. So I know I could still use more work on jazz vibes, but he did give me a good introduction of that. Yeah. I think I came in on day one and, you know, like played a Delacruz for him or something. And he was kind of like, what do you want to do? Like, you know, you studied with Chris Lamb. Like, what do you want me to say? What do you want to do in our lessons? So it was kind of like, let's make a plan. You're not going to come in here and play Delacruz for me.
Right.
So fair enough. I was like, but that's what I was comfortable with. You know, you do what you're comfortable with.
Sure. So. That's hilarious. Fair point. Do you have an assistantship?
I taught all of the jazz freshman classical half hour classical lesson, and I taught all of the classical freshman half hour of classical lessons. In addition to one or two percussion ensembles, so and that was a really good experience too, because I had just taught, you know, one or two private lesson students previous to that.
What kinds of rep were you playing at that point?
At that point, I was doing a little bit of composing myself. So I was prepping for my doctoral recital that was kind of a revamped version of my master's recital. So I realized that I was really tired of the traditional music recital. You know, you wear all black and you go out and you bow and you knee clap and you play one piece and you play a marimba piece and you play a piece of contrasting style and you know, everybody claps. Blah, 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 blah. Just the whole same. Yeah. And if you didn't really play this piece or this piece or this piece, did you really play a recital? You know, I kind of just wanted nothing to do with that. And I felt like the literature was a little sucked dry at that point. So I started writing some of my own stuff, and I did, I rewrote the entire, the some chapters of Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland.
Oh.
And so that it had to do with Alice falling down this rabbit hole and discovering this world of percussion. Yeah. And so it had this, the whole thing had this theme to it. And I had my aunt, who's a professional seamstress, and she made like a full Alice costume, and I had AstroTurf and I had fencing and I had a narrator, you know, who looked like an old man, Lewis Carroll, sitting in a big puffy chair and smoking a cigar. And he would read a chapter and then I'd play a piece, and then he'd read a chapter and I'd play a piece and everything. And, you know, there's a fog machine and lighting and all.
Of course.
And to be honest, at the time, that kind of thing wasn't really being done.
Yeah.
And you know, now I'm so excited to say that everybody's doing that kind of thing. It's like, if you play a recital these days and you don't have thematic content to it, what kind of recital is it? I mean, not to say that it can't be, but it's like every student of mine is coming to the table with a recital concept.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't used to be a thing. It was just like, you know, you used to just want to have a recital that had a good structure to it. I did 13 drums and I did Ribbon B, I did Xenakis, I did Chopin Fantasy Impromptu, where I had recorded the left hand or the marimba part previously, and then I played the vibe part or the right hand part live with myself on screen.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For the recital.
Yeah.
And I did some Temescal and, you know, it was a fun time. To be honest, recitaling is, like I said before, I just love playing with people.
You've just played with yourself.
Well, to be honest, there weren't many people in the area at that time. Greeley, Colorado is kind of in the middle of nowhere. I love playing with people, and I think the recital, the traditional solo recital, is something that's really needed and beneficial for students. And beyond that, I think that's kind of where it ends. Because we don't see people going to solo recital concerts, in public, outside of academic, settings.
At some point, did you, when you finished playing the Chopin, did you point to the screen and say, "I like how you play"? And then it says,
"Yeah, I did." We bowed to each other.
Exactly. Yes. After you. No, after you.
You play great.
Yes.
Yeah, you missed that A sharp though.
Nice. At Northern Colorado, what's the finishing? Is it like just a, like a lecture recital? Is it a full document? What's involved in finishing?
Kind of depends. You can either do two recitals or one really big one. So I did one pretty substantial one. And then four verbal comprehensive exams, four written comprehensive exams, and a full dissertation. My dissertation's, it's like around 150 pages.
Yeah.
I think that's a traditional substantial dissertation. So I wouldn't say the class requirements, the course requirements were out of control, because technically it can be done in 3 years. So it's kind of an expedited program, which mm-hmm. is also why I really liked it. Because a few that I looked at were even over 4 years.
So. Yeah. What was the focus of your document book?
A little bit of kind of what the recital was about. And so the title is Theater Percussion, Developing a 21st Century Genre Through the Connection of Arts, Percussion and Drama. And it's really talking about that 21st century playing, not just is about, but it also requires, it necessitates this sense of overstimulation. Mm-hmm. Because that's what's happening to us in our daily lives anyway.
Yeah.
Right? You know, we are constantly stimulated with technology and, you know, runners along the bottom of the news screen, as if the news isn't enough. We need to have the runners and notifications here and notifications there. And so it's almost like going to a concert and just listening to something is not enough. Even just listening and watching somebody play that one thing is not enough. People are wondering, okay, but if there's great technology and there are wonderful recordings and wonderful live recordings and virtual recordings and, you know, all of this stuff happening these days, a lot of which has been brought on by COVID, then why would I be interested in a performance that's just the same person playing the same stuff that everybody else has played, you know, doing the whole bow thing. And so it's kind of bringing about the idea and the awareness that this is where we have to go in our culture and in society. So the recital was kind of a culmination of that thought process.
Do you know Bonnie Whiting?
Because
she's done a ton of theatrical percussion as well. Like, God, now I have to think of the term. Narrative, like narratology, like study of narrative work and stuff like that.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So, because that was what I was looking that up. I was like, because I had her on some like months ago, but it was something I was like, this is a lot of the kind of stuff that she does is with a lot of the kind of thinking of this theatrical style that you're referring.
Yes. Absolutely. That's exactly, you know, that's where we are and that's where we need to go. And it was just kind of, being, you know, when I was writing the dissertation in what, like 2010, it was kind of like, you know, you had like Corporelle and these pieces that really were considered more new music. And so as opposed to it being more tangible. So my interpretation of what it sounds like with Bonnie and people like Maria Finkelmeyer and all is that it's more tangible for just the layperson. It's not highbrow. It's not intellectual.
Right.
And so it's cool. It's great to see that our industry is moving in that direction, because that's what I was hoping for.
Right. So is this when you go to Canada?
Yes. Yes. I went with my former partner to Canada. We were living outside of Toronto. And so I wrote my dissertation up there. I'd finished all my coursework here in Colorado. So was able to do my dissertation remotely. And so we were living outside of Toronto, and you know, it just like all freelance does, it took a little bit of time to get into the scene. A couple of years in, I was gigging regularly, weekly, and I had my first adjunct teaching position at Wilfrid Laurier University, which is an excellent music school up there, part of the university. So I was really, really excited and lucky to get that as kind of an introduction adjunct position into the world of university teaching.
Got it. What was the range of performing activities you had there?
You know, the majority of it was with a couple of professional orchestras. So the Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony and the Guelph Symphony Orchestra, which is a little more amateur, but both of those orchestras were semi-regular, so it was great to have that work. And then from there sprouted off some chamber work. I didn't really do any solo work. Didn't have so much the desire to, and necessarily all of the instruments involved, or see the payoff. But I did at that time when I was living in Canada, I did start my duo with Allison Miller, from New York City. I reached out to her. We connected, met in Detroit when she was doing a gig there near, or Ann Arbor, where she was doing a gig near U of M. And that's kind of where that rooted. And, we started, what turned out to be, a few years of great fun and conception and creation and composing. And then, you know, she, as can happen sometimes, she and her partner proceeded to have a couple kids, and her work just was going crazy in New York with, being the backup drummer for the Tonight Show and all of her work there. And then I moved back to Colorado. So the distance was not just Toronto to New York City, it was New York City to Colorado. So just made things a little bit more difficult. So it's become a little defunct at this point. But that was a great time, and we were able to kind of do the duo thing and go around to some universities and go around to some high schools and do a little bit of networking and touring there.
How much equipment did you take with you to Canada? And then the kind of second question, sort of related, what was it like to just get set up there in a different country?
First of all, I took every instrument that I owned, because we were making a full and complete move. So I took everything that I owned and fortunately had a large basement, so was able to house all of my equipment comfortably there. In terms of getting out there and starting in a new place, I don't think it really matters whether it's a new city or a new country. It's really all the same. There are going to be people wherever you go who have seniority because they've been there for years and they've set their roots in the ground. There's a strong amount of appreciation and respect that I think is owed to those people. And that's something I feel really strongly about. You know, our egos can really get the better of us in this industry where it is so much about competition that, you know, that's one thing when you're in school. There's a need for competition, right? Because competition makes us better. We see standards that are above us. We try to meet those standards. We try to go above those standards. Then people try to go above our standards. And it's a whole climbing ladder that's beneficial to our own development and the development of our craft, period. And yet there's a difference when you're out there in the real world. And that's called, you know, it's called making friends and having positive connections that can be in your favor, can work in your favor and to your benefit. But if we keep this same mentality of competition and trying to get ahead of one another, like we have in school, in the real world, I think that is grounds for just shooting yourself in the foot. You know, we can all see that sometimes when we move to a new place and somebody who's had the gigs for 15 plus years, I'm better than them. You know, look at my resume compared to theirs. And how do they get all the gigs and I don't? And that's where you're going to just damage yourself, because you have to understand that it's a lot of success in a new place comes with just simple time. It just, you have to stay in a place for a long time. And for somebody who moved 22 times before I was 22, that is not natural to me. You know, I'm like, okay, move to a new place. Boom. I want to have everything. I want it done because I'm probably going to be out of here in 5 years, less than. Well, you know, now that I've lived in a few places longer than 5 years consecutively, I realize the benefits of really just settling down, being in it for the long haul, and gaining relationships that are lifelong. So a lot of moving to a new place, whether it's Munich, Germany, or Toronto, Canada, or, Topeka, Kansas, you've got to put in your time and make positive, long-lasting connections.
Did you like living in Canada?
I sure did. The stereotypes are true. they're just, you know, of course it's a generalization, but they're just great, nice, positive people. And I really found that unanimously with the people that I met and the people I interacted with, and they were so welcoming. You know, one thing that one should take into account in moving to another country is that places like Canada have an unapologetic way of hiring, which is that they will always look to their own before branching out, whether it's for a professor job or a timpani position in a high-ranked orchestra. They will do auditions or interviews that first are for Canadians only or Canadian citizens, and then reach outwards. And I think that's fine. You know, I think that's wonderful. I think that's making sure that their own are looked after first. But that is definitely something that people might want to think about before moving to certain countries. So that's something that I came in contact with a little bit. It was never in a harsh way from the people. It was never like, oh, you're American, you're not welcome here. It was just like, we love Canadians so much first and foremost. And then we kind of love everybody else too. But in general, I really loved Canada. I think the music scene is very similar to the U.S. You're going to have pockets where the funding and the culture is well done, And then you're going to have pockets where there's just, there's no need or desire for it, and therefore no funding. So it's very similar in that sense as well.
Now, when you were there, did you get to travel around the country?
You know, I did not do as much as I would have liked. I never got out west. I only went to a little bit western Ontario, and then did a little bit of Quebec, just in Montreal area. But most of my time, in part because my partner was in veterinary school, which is very rigorous and nonstop. We didn't do much travel, and then of course when we had breaks, you know, we'd be coming back to the U.S. to visit family. So not as much as I would have liked to do to see such a beautiful country. Would love to someday get out to Vancouver and see the western side, but unfortunately not that go round.
Yeah, Vancouver's awesome. I highly recommend.
Yeah,
it's so good. And funny, oddly enough, I've been to a few other places. But I haven't been to Toronto, and I've heard everyone's been like, you need to get to Toronto.
Oh, it's, you know, I wouldn't go in January.
For sure, yeah. Not every month.
Or March, or December. Yeah, right. But it, otherwise, it is a really, really incredible place. And having spent so many years in New York City, and my mom living in New York City for well over a decade, New York is kind of a home to me, and Toronto is like a, it's like New York in the sense that it is such an integrated pot of cultures and people and belief systems, which brings about incredible culture, incredible food scene, and just a variety of lifestyles, period, yet it's quiet and it's clean. So it's kind of like New York, the best parts of New York City. It's got everything that New York's got to offer, except that like extreme hustle bustle, which is of course what also makes New York, New York.
Yeah.
But it's also why I can really only spend at this point in my life, like maybe 5 days there. And then I'm like, okay, I'm
done. Yeah. Definitely. All right, Julie, this, now we get to the last part of my show called Random Ask Questions.
Oh.
All right. First question is, this is where I want you to, I know we had talked about it very briefly in the previous time I chatted with you, but I want you to kind of go into the, would you refer to it as the end of the marimba or?
The case against.
The case against marimba.
Even more final.
Yes.
The case against the marimba, you know, that topic is kind of like it's opening a can of worms in our industry, which I'm ready to do for the sake of our students. This is my belief. This is my opinion, of course, and I understand and respect those of my other colleagues, of other professors in this industry. But it comes from the belief that we are teaching and hounding too much marimba in our university curricula. I studied in New York City at a conservatory, and yes, we did a lot of orchestral repertoire and excerpts. And then we did almost an equal amount of formal marimba. Now, when you look at the numbers of getting out of school and what you do with playing formal marimba, it doesn't add up. It's not 50-50. It's not even near that. You know, I think we can all probably list 5 solo marimbists, not in the U.S., in the world, who make their living doing that. And that's it. So we're talking, what, 0.1 or who knows, whatever percentage, 0.1% might become a solo marimbist.
Oh, probably less than that.
But otherwise, exactly. Yeah. Definitely, probably far less than that. Now, that's not to say that that we, you know, after Nancy Zeltzman is finished and Keiko Abe is finished and Evelyn Glennie is finished and all, that's not to say that we won't need a resurgence of those five. But essentially, I think the need is really only about five. We need marimba in university curricula. That is not the question. But the amount that we enforce is, I think, imbalanced when it comes to what is going to be done with it once you leave school. So yes, we need to learn formal at marimba, 100%. Do we need to learn it to the extent that we do? No, absolutely not. I have been out in the freelance scene for the last 15 years. I might play marimba once a year in a performance. Once a year. Now, being in a university system as a professor now, I play a little bit more marimba, but that's because it's within the university system again. So it's kind of this cycle of it only being relevant and pertinent within a university. But guess what? The music scene is not all within a university. It's in orchestras. It's in chamber music. It's in creating your own group or your own duo or trio or quartet. But, you know, let's just talk about one thing alone, and that's the technicality and the logistics of using a marimba, right? If we're going to talk about that, you know, we're dealing with, okay, first of all, I'm sitting now in my 8x12 studio shed that was built on the backside of my house for the purpose of teaching and practicing. Now it is 8x12 specifically because I needed to fit a 5-octave marimba in here, which is about roughly 9 feet. Now, the fact that I had to build my shed based on a 5-octave marimba that I might play once a year outside of a university doesn't seem to make sense. And then you talk about the actual assembly of the instrument and movement of the instrument. So, you know, we might spend in total, 25 minutes getting a marimba into a car that has to be large enough. We might spend 25 minutes getting it out and reassembling it for a concert that you might play for 10 people who don't know what a marimba is, nor do they really care. I see marimba being the most relevant within a university system, but not the real world. Now, that is not to say that it is not an instrument that I love. I do love it. I think it is absolutely beautiful. But I think we are confusing enjoyment of playing something and enjoyment of practicing something, right? Marimba, you know, is more fun to practice than a practice pad, right? It's so many more levels of musicality than practicing first page of stick control on a practice pad, right?
Yep.
Yet we are confusing enjoyment for practicality. And enjoyment, we are confusing enjoyment for real life work and jobs and getting ahead. And I fear that we are putting too much time into something that will not pay off in the future.
I often think of, I'm glad you made the point about the car. Because it's like my wife, there's a couple ways, like my wife will say things like, whenever I've spoken about it, like I'll talk about a piece. This is a somewhat related, but you know, like I'll talk about a piece and she will say, well, do not say more or to not speak longer than the actual length of the piece. You know, it's like there's one good, assessment. One thing I think about, it's not marimba related, but it's when you would hear about like a jazz vibraphone player in New York City who has to take their vibes on the subway to go to a gig, and how much time are they spending versus to get to the gig with their instrument versus the playing.
Exactly. And that's where we can forget all of this when we're in a university, right?
Right.
Because it's at the ready. right? We have oversized elevators to take us straight from our practice room to the performance hall. We just roll that little sucker down the hallway and we're good to go.
The doors are the right size.
Of course. Yeah. It's all perfect in a university, right? And we have people who want to listen to it too, right? Because they are also musicians and they are our friends and they are our colleagues. Right. And they are our peers. But it is wholly different out in the real world. Yeah. It's not to say it's not a pretty instrument.
Right.
It's just that it's the logistics and appreciation are very, very different.
Great. Okay, another question. Take this wherever you want. Being a percussionist who is also a woman, your thoughts?
It is difficult. It has always been difficult, and I think it will continue to be difficult for a while. That is most certainly not to say, and here, this is already a problem, that my first thought in just saying that is to follow up with a disclaimer that I am not saying this to be a victim. That's already a problem.
Right.
Is that was my first thought. Oh, I have to be defensive. I have to be defensive because I don't want anybody to think that I'm a victim, right?
Sure.
So that is a problem. Yeah. I wish I could be able to say that and not think that I would be pigeonholed or ousted by somebody out there.
Right.
But in all honesty, if I take that fear away, yes. I mean, I have dealt with, everything from middle school when I won first in the state, written in Sharpie on my snare drum head the next morning was a boy who said, girls don't deserve first chair. Everything nice. From when I studied in Germany and one of my colleagues came in the room, locked the door and said, pull up your shirt or I'm not leaving. Everything from, you know, and then quote unquote, the little things of, that are far less harmless. But a difference in gender roles, which is that, I could be playing at the symphony and somebody says, oh, no, don't pick that up. Don't pick that up. I'll get that for you. I'll get that for you. I know what I got into. I chose to be in this industry. This is not something that, and I chose to be in this field with everything that it comes with. And part of that is lifting a lot of heavy stuff. And so yes, those things are harmless and absolutely, I know because many of these are my friends coming from a place of consideration and, you know, chivalry, gentleman chivalry kind of thing. It is also a separator in terms of what gender roles should do and maybe can do. So it is always there. I'm currently in a position at the university where I have a studio of only guys. And I question a lot. Do they need a man? Do they need a man leading them? Do they wish they had a man? You know, and these are kind of internal struggles that I have. I have no idea what they think. hopefully they don't think that, but it just goes to show that it crosses our minds in a way that it doesn't for a man. I'll never forget when my timpani teacher from high school, Carol Stumpf, the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, she said to me, you know, a compliment for a conductor, from a conductor to a woman is getting the hand to play softer because they will always expect you to not play loud enough.
Right.
And so from that moment on, there was like a strength that, you know, of course, reasonably musical. I didn't just try to smash every pianissimo that I had.
Yeah.
But if there was a, you know, if it was, you know, a true forte, then I went for it maybe a little more, just because I was taught that a woman will always be looked at as not quite giving enough. And it's sad, but I think that at times, I won't generalize and say that that's true, but I think at times that definitely can be true, more so than the opposite, more so than thinking that we would automatically play louder than softer or stronger than weaker. So it's something that is definitely there. I don't think it's something that has defined my career. I choose for it not to. But it is most certainly always there.
Do you find that it takes up a lot, or I don't know if it's changed over the years, but do you find that some of these issues, whether they're microaggressive or macroaggressive, I guess maybe is the cover, but some of these things that you've discussed are in your mind a lot? Are they compartmentalized and you can kind of feel like it's not really affecting me as much as it one time did? What do you?
You know, I wish I could compartmentalize it. I wish it was more of a conscious, and maybe that's something that I need to work with a little bit. I wish it were more of a conscious, I'm going there, and kind of awareness of when I think these things. But I think it's just kind of ingrained at this point. It's been happening for so long that I think it's natural for me to think, when I'm in a room full of 12 studio students that are all guys, I think it's just so natural for me to think and question and worry, you know, do they need a man to feel, because what we do is so one-on-one,
right?
It's so interpersonal. Mm-hmm. In combination with being, you know, with the education part of it.
Right.
And I don't think they need that, right? In fact, who knows? Maybe they need more of a maternal kind of thing. I'm not sure. Maybe they need just the opposite.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone is different,
right,
too.
Yeah.
And what goes for one doesn't go for the other.
Right.
But the fact that those thoughts regularly come up in my mind and I don't even think of them as being odd or being different is probably alarming in and of itself, meaning that they've been there for so long that I don't even think of them as being abnormal.
You're making me think about my own interactions, particularly with the, helping someone with equipment. I just try to help, but I'm sure that has been taken as not that. Even though that's what I think I'm doing, you know?
Right. Well, and again, that's where it's a tough thing. And I would never say to a guy, you know, hey, I'd definitely say, oh, that's okay, I got it. But I would never say to somebody, you know, you're infringing on my womanhood kind of thing.
Sure.
You know, because I do know that it's coming from a very kind place, at least intentionally. I don't think it's going through a man's head like it's going through my head. Oh, I think she's weak and can't carry it. I don't think that. But it's just part of our society. It's part of history. It's part of tradition. Man equals strong, and in addition to the traditional chivalry and manners that gentlemen are supposed to have in helping out a woman.
Yeah. And it's going through.
Times are changing a little.
Yeah. I was going to say, and it's that it doesn't go through a man's head like at all.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, we're not so far off from the time when that was not only acceptable but encouraged.
Right.
You know, if we even go back to the early 60s, which many of our colleagues were working then, then it was not only acceptable to do that, it was expected to do that and treat a woman that way. And so I do think it is a fresh, and that's why there's so much, you know, I give, there's so much laxness, I guess, to, you know, to cutting guys a break, because it is such a new thing that it's not part of our culture anymore. And women can do much of what men can do. And we certainly can in this field. And we've proven that. So there is definitely a small tribe of us.
Fortunately growing, I want to say.
Definitely. Fortunately growing.
Yeah.
But you know, I will still play concerts at least twice a year. I'll have somebody come up to me after a performance and say, I've never seen a woman playing the drums.
Right, yeah.
And that's your constant reinforcement of, or, you know, and reminder that what you're doing is odd to some people.
Yeah.
So even if I'm not thinking these things are constantly put on you. Your weirdness, your strangeness in your position is visible to other people. And hopefully we're moving in the direction where someday that's just not even on somebody's radar. Just like in Europe, a male flute player is not on anybody's radar. Here, a male flute player or a male harpist, it's like, oh, they're certainly gay. Definitely have to be gay. You know,
right.
No,
right.
No. When did, why is flute, you know, a female instrument, a feminine instrument?
Yeah.
And hopefully percussion will someday, lose that status as well.
A few more questions, much less stressful or serious. Has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how'd they do it?
I think the closest would have been Chris Lamb when I was at MSM. And it wasn't so much how I played, but more kind of how I acted. He called me Lucy, something that I reminded him about Lucille Ball, I guess. And because I kind of came out of my shell after the first couple of years, and he and I don't know, just became jokey and sarcastic, I guess. And so he called me Lucy, and he'd do some little inflections here and there. But that's the closest, you know. I really pick up on so many, playing wise, I pick up on so many little things, and almost try not to have one bit of flair that pigeonholes me into being a Julie Strom thing. And maybe I overthink that too much, because I see some people that really works for, and then I see some people that I think, oh, that's not really working for them, and I don't want to be that person. But it's kind of like with languages, where if I go to Germany, suddenly, like, I you know, everybody thinks I'm from Germany because I have a German accent, and it's just like, it's not intentional. It's just I pick up. It's probably because I moved so much when I was a kid. I just pick up on things around me. Whether it's sounds or inflections or actions and things. And so I think I have a lot of little nuances, but nothing that really defines my style in one particular way. So I wouldn't say that there's too much to impersonate. Let me put it that way.
Got it. All right. What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
Whiplash was terrible. I just cannot. I just can't. Only was forced to see it 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
After however many years.
Yeah.
And it was just terrible. I mean, there was really no plot. It didn't finish up.
Yeah.
There was no finish to it. I like a movie that has a little, you know, box and bow. There was none of that. And it was just completely misrepresentative of our industry.
Right, yeah.
You know, all the people, all my friends who go, oh, is that how they do it? Is that how they do it? You know, it's like, come on. No.
Yeah.
So that, I think that was a horrible movie. It is a great movie. Oh gosh, it's not going to be as deep as it should be. A great movie. I have a tough time seeing many movies more than once. I'm usually like a one and done-er.
Mm-hmm.
A great movie though. I mean, if I'm going to go deep, I got to say Shawshank Redemption.
That's a classic. Okay. Yeah.
Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, but then along the kind of stupider lines, I love me some Father of the Bride.
Cut the cock.
You know, I got a cold laying on the couch drinking Gatorade. I want me some Father of the Bride.
Oh, yeah. Good stuff. Nice. Where is somewhere that you have not traveled to that you still want to get to?
Well, like I said earlier, Vancouver is one. I would love to go to Rome. I would love to go a lot. I've really not been around Italy much at all, aside from Venice. I would love to go to Cuba and just spend a week just immersing myself in Afro-Cuban drumming. And drinking margaritas.
Yeah.
And I would love to go to Thailand and do a similar thing, minus the Afro-Cuban part and probably the margarita part.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But yeah, culturally, I'd really say I'd love to spend some time in Latin America and then in Thailand, really.
All right, now what's something pop culturally related, maybe something more obscure, that if you meet someone and they're like, hey, I like this, you go, we're good.
Oh, I'm a closeted, massive, massive tennis fanatic.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Oh, is this our click?
Maybe, yeah.
Yes. I am a massive tennis fanatic. People always follow that up with, do you play? I don't even really play. I dislocated my shoulder, had shoulder surgery. It's still very uncomfortable when I go to do those side motions. So I can play for like 15 minutes before it'll start hurting, or have to switch to my left hand. But just that I love watching the stats. I love watching my people. Roger Federer's personal note to me,
yes,
for my 30th birthday, although Rafa will always be my dreamy man.
Interesting.
Rafa is my number one and will always be. I still very much respect Roger Federer.
I see. All right.
Major tennis nerd. Major tennis nerd.
Okay. Well, that's less exciting. I was hoping, because I usually follow that up with Federer or Nadal.
I like that they've kind of developed a bromance over the years and
yeah.
supported each other. You know, I also look at the person. I don't just look at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been vehemently Rafa Nadal. But over the past couple of years, I've gained a little more respect for Federer. I mean, yeah, for mm-hmm. Federer too. So.
Got it. I was all excited, Julie, and then
why? Because you're a big
Federer. I'm a big Federer guy. Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. I can get on board with that.
Yeah.
A couple years ago, I wouldn't have been able to.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I mean, and it's kind of the same thing with Rafa. I always say, I want to be as good at something as he is on clay. Like that would be my.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, yeah, he is the king of clay and probably always will be.
Yeah. I feel like whenever I see my thing for Federer has always been that he's so much fun to watch all the time, particularly when he's playing someone who is just kicking their butt. Because he'll just be trying shots out. He'll be like, you know, guessing early to just like stroll to the middle for some of these drop shots.
Yeah.
And just like he's the magician to me. That's like that's part of my, my thing.
Yeah. Well, and I can agree. He's more fun to watch. He's more nuanced. He has more tricks in his bag. You know, Nadal is. I feel like he was the first or one of the first just power players.
Yeah.
It was all about his muscles.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, when in the past did we have a player? I mean, Pete Sampras, Agassi, they weren't muscle guys.
No, he's jacked.
Seriously, he was kind of the first muscle bodybuilder on the court that we had. So he's not as, I can definitely say he's not as fun to watch because it's just power, kind of like a Serena. It's just power, power, power. But, you know, Nadal, Djokovic, I mean, Federer, Djokovic, they've definitely got the drop shots that are a lot more fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, they all, like, the ability to get to balls is ridiculous.
I mean, the spread of their legs.
Oh, I know, yeah.
It's like, you know, when I go out on a court for my 15 minutes at a time, I'm like, from this side to that side feels like it's a mile away. How do they do that?
Yeah.
Reach and wingspan is brilliant.
I've said this before, but the 2013, I got to go to Wimbledon on opening day. And Federer was playing. I mean, the reason I wanted to go is because Federer was the opening – because he had won the previous year. He plays the first match on center court. And that was incredible. And he won the match in like an hour and 10 minutes. I mean, he just wiped the floor of the guy. But I got to see Federer and then Nadal play, warm up on a practice, like as did like most of the people who were there. I mean, it was one of those random things. And Federer was like, everything was just smooth, like, you know, just relaxed. He's hitting drop shots. Backhand drop shots just over the net that are like five in a row. They're just dropping in like nothing. And Nadal shows up like 20 minutes later. He is hitting lasers, like the hardest things I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, you're hearing the whistle off the ball. I mean, it was like the contrast was. And the other thing I didn't realize is Rafa's like 6'1". Like he always seemed like he was shorter to me, but he's actually. Like relatively tall. I mean, he's like, because Fed is like 6'2", 6'3", and I think Djokovic is like 6'5". So there's like, you know, the height's there, but it's.
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected that from Nadal, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, their difference in playing is, I think, why those two, you know, aside from like a Sampras Agassi, are the most fun to watch because they have to adjust.
Right.
They have to adjust to. You know, to their chemistry on the court.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right, a couple more. Strangest, funniest, or most bizarre performance moment that involves you?
I guess it was a couple years ago, a player was that I was playing with. We were doing Holst Planets and, you know, like second bar of Mars. You know, here in Colorado, it's extremely dry.
Yeah.
And he's using a skin head on a snare drum.
Yeah.
And second bar of Mars. And he just goes, it sticks straight through the drum. And, you know, he had to play that entire opener just like that. There was no other option. So that was a little embarrassing. But other than that, not really any, not anything really that stands out, fortunately.
Hmm. Oh, good for you. All right. And Julie, last one. What one piece of art, movies, music, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, visual art, poetry, whichever, etc., has impacted you the most recently?
You know, I'm really into the work of Banksy.
Yeah.
The artist Banksy, the anonymous artist Banksy. I went to an exhibit, technically an it was not his exhibit because he does not technically put his stuff out there to be known or exhibited in this kind of way. But I went to a full exhibit of his in Lisbon last summer in Portugal, and that was absolutely incredible. I love art that has an obvious, whether, and when I say art, I mean music, I mean, theater, I mean visual art. I love when it has an obvious connection to what's going on in the world. You know, I think that's how art as a whole develops, and you know, whether it's abstract or a little bit more blatant, like Banksy's work. I absolutely love what he does in terms of bringing to light consumerism and materialism and the little people of the world. And so I highly respect his work and follow him on Instagram, and I'm just always waiting for a new one to come up because you never know when it's going to be and or where it's going to be in which city in the world. I love that anonymity aspect of who he is too. I think that's really cool and probably necessary for him to stay safe and unimprisoned. But he has a really big impact on me.
Was there a specific piece?
Or she, I should say.
Sure, yeah. They, who knows?
Right.
Was there a specific piece from that Lisbon that really stuck with you?
There's like a sequence of rats, and it's kind of rats in settings, rats in subways, rats around cities, and it's to kind of emulate the effects of consumerism and what that's doing to society. And I think it was just powerful. It was powerful to me. But that entire exhibit, there wasn't one that I thought, meh.
Right.
They were all really powerful.
Awesome. All right, Julie, we are done. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It has been total pleasure, yes, for sure.
So great to get so much time to chat to Julie for these interviews. It was awesome to meet her, and I wish her the best in the upcoming year, and hopefully we'll get a chance to meet in person very soon. This week's rave, in the spirit of the season, is the classic 1970 TV special, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. I'm not much for specific holiday movies or shows. I've never had a habit of watching something every year at this time. But at some point when I started dating my now wife, she told me that her favorite holiday special is this one. It always shows up on TV at some point or multiple points, and it's now a tradition for both of us to watch. Santa Claus is Coming to Town is one of the classic Rankin-Bass stop-motion animation productions that were made in the 1960s and 70s. Other well-known specials of theirs are Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and The Year Without a Santa Claus. This particular special has Fred Astaire as the narrator slash postman and Mickey Rooney playing the adult Santa Claus, and many others involved. Aside from now, I practically know the plot and the dialogue and the songs by heart, a number of which are completely corny. The reason that I enjoy this special is that the heart of the message still resonates. It's all about giving and trying to be better and attempting to bring joy in whatever way you possibly can. Yes, it's wrapped up in a Christmas story, but those aspects really are important all the time. We're a big fan, and you know what? Anytime the song put one foot in front of the other, comes on, we are all in there. So check this special out, or whatever allows you to have joy at this time. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there, on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I will catch you next time. Stay safe, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.